New revelations reported this week on JEA's failed attempt to privatize. Duval County sees its highest murder rate in decades. And a North Florida congressman accused of racism. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for being with us. Just ahead, the top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable, and you can join us. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, the man in overalls stops by with some tips on turning a new leaf in this new year and growing your own groceries. That's later. But first, it's Friday, and what a busy week in the news. We are so pleased to welcome Dan Scanlon with the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Freelance journalist Claire Goforth is here.
Good morning.
Tim Gibbons of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
And A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics.
Good morning.
So good to have all four of you here because there is so much to talk about this week. My goodness, everything from a Twitter dust-up between Congressman John Rutherford and his colleague in Congress, AOC, over those Iran strikes. We're also going to talk about sobering crime statistics once again for Duval County. That's all ahead. But let's begin the hour with the latest controversy surrounding the now aborted sale of JEA. The TU reports today that top Lenny Curry staffer Brian Hughes was spotted meeting with Florida Power and Light officials during the so-called cone of silence period as JEA was soliciting bids from private utilities. At the same time, Jacksonville City Councilman Matt Carlucci is calling for Hughes to resign. And amid all this, a new group of power brokers formed this week to demand answers in the JEA scandal. We learn more about this effort. It's called OurJax.com. As on yesterday's show, we welcomed former JEA Vice President Mike Hightower. Let's listen.
It has just, from our perspective across this community, I think the two words are outrage and enraged. And so what we have done, we have put together a group of civic leaders. And what we're really trying to do is Jacksonville has a long history of coming together and doing things together. And what our coalition has formed is to return to those things that Jacksonville has always been known for: transparency, integrity, accountability, and local control here in Northeast Florida.
Now, some might disagree. Jacksonville has always been known for those things.
Melissa,
but that said, we want your calls as we kick off the media roundtable at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page, as always, is a lively conversation. AG, let's begin with you. Mayor Curry's top administrator, Brian Hughes, denied this week having a conversation with the CEO of Florida Power and Light about the push to privatize JEA. He was spotted by several people talking to the guy at a Jaguars game in October. The CEO of FP&L says he spoke with Hughes about issues related to economic development, but not JEA. This isn't illegal if they were talking, but it's not a good look for the administration.
Well, Ian, in the context of this JEA sale and the perception that FPL was a front runner and that, you know, they had an advantage in the process, it's a bad look. But, you know, the thing is, Florida Power and Light plays very heavily in politics in the state, especially on the Republican side of the ledger. Governor DeSantis has a real comfort level with them in terms of storm recovery and all those things. And, you know, while I would not have situated those two boxes next to each other and had the door open, I mean, that obviously was something they probably shouldn't have done in retrospect. I hear tell a lot of people were in that box, moving from one to the other, having conversations. And that's kind of the way business is done. I mean, if Hugh says and Salagi says they didn't have that conversation, then perhaps they didn't have that conversation. You know, if there is independent corroboration that something was discussed, that's a different matter. But, you know, right now, a lot of this is implication.
Okay,
well, right,
go
right
ahead,
on the
Dan.
Front page of our paper, Chris Hong states that Hughes confirms he had a seat in that FPL suite, and obviously FPL was pushing hard at the time lobbying, but he says they didn't have a substantive conversation.
That's the question.
And Salagi says they talked a lot about economic development, but not about JEA.
Well,
it
is the question. I mean, it's the big question, but I don't want to, we shouldn't jump over the perception bit of it. The idea that why I think the public in part was outraged over the entire JEA thing is because of this feeling of a lack of transparency, a feeling that things are being done behind closed doors. somebody should have looked at the optics of that and said, even if they're going to abide by the rules, it just looks really bad. And that, you know, optics matters in politics.
It's 549-2937 to join us now amid all this. Claire Goforth, full disclosure, as we always point out when you join us, your husband works at JEA. Amid all this, Jacksonville City Councilman Matt Carlucci this week put out a statement calling for Brian Hughes to resign, saying that he has become too divisive of a force in city government and that it's time for him to go. Your thoughts?
I don't really think that's going to be likely. I mean, Lenny Curry's in a position right now where his back is against the wall and Brian Hughes is his closest ally. So I just don't see a scenario in which he's going to cleave himself from the person that most people see as the guy that's really, you know, got his back in every situation when he's really up against the ropes.
Yeah, I mean, if Carlucci wants action on this front, a way to go about it potentially is to introduce a resolution saying no confidence in Hughes or whatever. Mm-hmm. That would be the move. I think issuing a midnight press release, as Carlucci did, while it was, you know, really interesting optics, and I was up at 1 o'clock in the morning writing that thing up, you know, it really is something about moving the process along. And that's the question. Is Carlucci actually going to do something, or is this just another, you know, press release with weird formatting and bad spelling at some odd hour of the night?
We'll all right. And let me also point out, amid all this, we also learned this week that a group of local civic and business leaders has formed a new entity, OurJax.com. And as we listened to Mike Hightower, former JEA Vice President of Public Affairs, on this show yesterday, there is increasing pressure on the administration, the state attorney's office, to city council, to get to the bottom of this whole affair.
It will be interesting to see what OurJax does. The Business Journal sat down with Hightower and some of the other organizers before, you know, the group was launched. And They clearly want to lead this push for transparency, for documents to come out. It sounds like they plan on lobbying or at least advocating against the bill in the State House to take away the ability of utilities to contribute to city coffers. It will be interesting to see what they actually do. I think it also has to be at least acknowledged that it's a group pushing for transparency, but we don't know who all the members are based on how they're set up. You know, it's... The people who have come out are definitely civic-minded, long-time involved in leading the city sort of people. It will be interesting to see who else is actually a part of it.
You know, it's interesting. When I last talked about this, this was still an ongoing here. It was an ongoing plan to sell JEA, and FPNL was really doing some heavy advertising. Suddenly, disappeared from the airwaves. So doesn't that say something, too?
You know, it's interesting to see the donor class become a circular firing squad in Curry's second term. You know, a lot of these people, they walk together, rock together, quote, 7 seconds, you know, for 5 years on the same fundraising reports, at the same fundraisers, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the 2019 mayoral campaign was a joke. There was no real discussion there. The donor class all went one way. And now there's this late in the game call for transparency. I mean, the referendum, the last two elections on Tallahassee-style politics, that's what Curry brought to the city. You know, Curry brought a Tallahassee operation, and the donor class, overwhelmingly with their checkbooks, supported it. Was JEA discussed in that period? I mean, I know that the privatization discussion, you know, writ large, you know, went on from the beginning of Curry's first term. The JEA issue has been live for 2 years. So
why only now you're saying come out with outrage?
I mean, if Hightower, you know, et al. Are not, you know, part of Zahn's inner circle, or not part of Zahn's inner circle when Zahn was relevant, you know, that is a question. But, you know, really it's the Tallahassee-style politics that the city embraced at the ballot box.
Well, I think that this goes back to the entire Carlucci-Hughes thing where he says Brian Hughes has become... I don't really get the sense that Brian Hughes has changed. I think Brian Hughes has been Brian Hughes, you know, his entire time, both in campaigning and in governing in campaign mode. But the idea of it, in some ways, nothing has changed. It's not like Jacksonville in the past couple of weeks has gone through a sea change. This is how the Curry administration has governed. It's how it campaigned. It's how it's governed. you know, since they came in.
I mean, they seem like they've changed their tune because it's become politically untenable. I mean, Lenny Curry has been the way he is. Brian Hughes has been the way he is since the beginning. And now that the public is in an uproar over the JEA sale and the just terrible optics, I mean, the great reporting by the Florida Times Union is showing us every day almost that there's a new revelation about these deals that Aaron Zahn had with people who were involved with JEA in ways that we would say are unethical. And now that all of this is coming out, people are changing what they're saying and, you know, they're starting to push back. But what's going to happen after this? I mean, Lenny Kearney's termed out. How is this really going to affect him? And what is going to change in this city now? I mean, are these people going to continue with this push for transparency when we have the next sort of mayor coming in and the next city council coming in? Or is it just going to go back to the way it was before?
Good questions and lots of calls. It's our Friday roundtable. You can join us. 549-2937. Andy is on the west side. Andy, good morning.
Good morning. I appreciate your program, and I thank you for the topic today and for your crew. I have three specific suggestions. First of all, I think Brian Hughes definitely needs to resign. Who cares what he was talking about? It's wrong for him to accept a gift from far, power, and light at a time like this. It's wrong for him to sit with him at all. But the three suggestions would be, number one, we should enforce the requirement in our charter that the mayor only appoint people to staggered terms. We knew something was going wrong in Jacksonville, something corrupt was happening. And then he forced the JEA members off and took over the JEA and ended the tradition, the charter requirement of staggered terms. Second suggestion would be that the legislature should mandate that each electric utility in Florida should require that the employees of the utility should elect a person to serve on the board of their electric utility. I guess that's really the key thing. And then lastly, I don't think any electric utility should be sold without the approval of the legislature.
Oh, that's an interesting point. That's Andy Johnson, I believe, on the line, former talk show host and member of the Florida House. Andy, thank you for that. And citizens out there are suggesting changes to local governments that could be meaningful reforms, honestly, though, in particular, changing the city's charter with regard to how these board members are appointed, having more oversight into the process. That's certainly going to be another point of contention for some time to come in this city.
Yeah, that was Garrett Dennis's idea 2 years ago. Garrett Dennis was saying have the staggered terms, and you know he got no traction with that back when JEA sale push part one was happening. Now it's kind of a different matter, but you know, does it get the requisite votes to overcome a potential mayoral veto?
You also have the issue, and not to be cynical about it, but you look at things like the recent appointment of Dane Gray to the JEA board, which people are now, you know, somewhat up in arms about, which city council passed. So the idea of, you know, city council is going to nominate these people. Okay. You know, if you have a newly emboldened city council, sure, that can make a difference. But by and large, if your city council already has an oversight role, now it's different from the staggered terms thing, which just is
doing oversight because it essentially sort of looks like
And to be clear, these boards and commissions did all have staggered terms. Mayor Curry disrupted that by purging people off boards and commissions before they had completed their terms
because they weren't being transparent. I mean, if you go back to the irony, seriously. Yeah.
And so for meaningful reform, you would have to, the people calling for change would say, take the power out of the hands of simply one person, the mayor, and spread the power to appoint around to more than one entity.
I find it interesting, you know, the Business Journal covers kind of the business activities of a range of the city authorities, and the Port Authority, for example, is looking at making changes in how people can leave and then end up working for the authority, which isn't the problem that anybody has pointed to there, but they explicitly said, looking at JEA, we kind of want to put things in place to make sure there are no problems. Maybe this is a moment where some of Jacksonville's leadership basically rethinks things and says, let's move in a different direction.
Maybe. It's a thin pool, though. We see the same people appointed over and over again to these board slots. And another question that we have is, without the sale of JEA, what's going to fill the revenue hole that's coming for the city in the next decade? You know, that $120 million contribution isn't happening after 2023. Yeah, so we're going to have real questions, capital budgets, everything like that.
JA has told bond rating agencies that they anticipate being able to do it until 2030. I mean, that's not what they told the public, but if, you know, if you're JP Morgan, that's what they told you.
All right, let's go to Neil on the West Side. Neil, good morning.
Good morning. I think it's interesting that Mr. Hightower, who was JEA board chair before he came on board as an employee of JEA, did not speak up when there was a purge of the JEA board. And again, that's sort of ground zero of a plan to take over and sell JEA through this process, which began at the very beginning of the Curry administration. So I'm wondering what else has been looked at, if anything, going back to the very beginning when the board chair under Alvin Brown and vice chair were pushed out of JEA, and you didn't hear anything from Mr. Hightower about those acts, as far as at least in the media.
Thanks for that. You know, and when Mike Hightower was on the air yesterday, he did get that question posed to him from listeners. And his response was, look, I don't have the best answer for you. All I can say is that I am trying to do the right thing now. So for the record, that was his response to those concerns. Dan Scanlon.
I mean, he's not the only one who now is starting to sing a different tune now that things have changed.
You know, it's interesting for those of us who've been around a long time. The JEA used to be nothing but good news. Our rates were low. Their PR department responded to every request we had with a smile. It's just an amazing turnabout in the space of a few years to a wall that is now responding barely to record requests. We never talked to them. I never talked to them about anything.
Okay, yeah. Here's a tweet. Yeah, really. I'm sure she's enjoying her retirement. Mm-hmm. Former spokeswoman for JEA. Here's a tweet from a listener. How much outrage or concern is there among Republican voters in Jacksonville over JEA, the Kids Hope Alliance scandal, the school board referendum, downtown development boondoggles, and violence in the city? Until that voting bloc gets really upset, change will be hard.
That's a fair point. I mean, we can sit here and talk until we're blue in the face, and people that are, you know, loud voices in the city can complain. But until those super voters who are going to reliably vote Republican every single election change their minds, get angry enough to vote for someone else, there's really not going to be much meaningful change.
Let's go to John in downtown Jax. John, you're on the air.
Something about JEA that most people don't know is that according to EPA and Engineering News Record, that Plant Cheer, it's not a refinery in Texas or a paper mill in Maine. It's Plant Cheer in Macon, Georgia. And guess who owns a good part of Unit 4 up there?
And are you talking about the Plant Vogel? The Georgia?
No, this is Plant Cheer in Macon, Georgia.
Okay.
All right. As far as Vogel now, okay, most people don't know that there's an $8.2 billion federal guarantee by the Obama administration on that plant. So, like I said, just bear that in mind that Southern's a big company. They own Georgia Power, Alabama Power, Mississippi Power, Gulf Power, and about four plants here in Florida. So anybody that can hire 54 lobbyists with 12 legal firms in Washington, you know that you're up against something. So don't have anything to do with them if you can help it, because you're going to come out the loser. Anyway, that's all. Bye.
I hear you, John. Thank you for that. Tim.
Going back to the earlier caller and that issue of are people going to push for a change? And, you know, AG and Claire actually pretty cover this sort of stuff more. But the idea that in the last election, Curry won overwhelmingly, but there was a general sense that there wasn't much in the way of an option being offered. So I think really what those voters need is a choice. And it might be a Democrat, it might be a Republican. I mean, Jacksonville is known for having, you know, Republicans run against each other. So the idea that when part of the political class's responsibility, if they do think that change is needed, is to push people forward who will be those change agents.
Well, they did have that candidate. They had Anna Broche, who is partially Democrat, partially Republican, and she had one big donor. That was Michael Ward. You know, they waited, they launched, they couldn't get any other real money behind her. So, you know, they had a chance for that dialogue, and they punted on that dialogue. And I don't know what changed in the period between then and now, except that it's become politically untenable.
Right. If the RJAX group had been, you know, had lined up behind Broche, whoever those people are, that, you know, that sort of thing could have made a difference.
I honestly think, I've said this before, that the calculus on this shifted due to the just old-fashioned shoe leather reporting of the Florida Times Union. I really do believe that was the decisive factor that shifted the Overton window over from everything's fine to this is an outrage. And I give credit to the reporters and columnists of the TU.
To hear them behind me as each new piece of paperwork came in, you want to have excitement in a newsroom, that's it. And I'm sure you had some of the same here, Melissa. It has been a blast. Yesterday, literally as all this stuff was happening, to have Mike Talbert and Mike Hightower come in the other day and do the sit down.
Speaking of that, here's an email from a listener. Joe emails the show. So here's my question. What is next for JEA? Mike Hightower hinted they are still looking at other options. What is the future for JEA? Are they just going to continue on being publicly owned utility?
No, they are. They are looking at least two other options: being a co-op and doing an IPO. I mean, the everybody should be very clear on that. The intent to negotiate, the invitation to negotiate, process is over. The idea of JEA is looking at doing something different, that's not over. This will continue.
And when we've heard leadership like the Jacksonville Civic Council come out against this particular process, you have to notice they're careful not to say, let's not do it ever. They're just saying the way that it has gone this time is not working and we need to start over. Not we need to scrap the idea entirely.
Well, if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest headlines from the week with Claire Goforth, Dan Scanlon, Tim Gibbons, A.G. Gankarski, and yours truly. And you, call us up. We're going to shift gears now and talk crime numbers in Duval.
We weren't talking crime before.
The number to join us, 549-2937. Sheriff Mike Williams spoke out about the alarming number of violent deaths Jacksonville saw in 2019. 158 homicides recorded in the city. Dan, you've been reporting that is causing JSO to reassess how police operate in Jacksonville.
I sat down with him for 20 minutes this week, and frustrating and tragic in many ways were the two initial comments when I asked, how are you feeling? He's frustrated because despite the fact that he has, with the mayor's help, hired many new officers, we have a lot of officers and brass who are now retiring, so it's sort of a losing battle there. He says he has not asked for any new officers in this year's budget because there's capital needs, and I'll tell you, there's some old police cruisers out there, so I can guess that's probably necessary. But I'll tell you, it's every few hours I'm on a crime scene line covering a homicide as late as yesterday afternoon with a man on a motorcycle who got shot at multiple times. It's horrendous. And repeatedly the sheriff said the community's got to get involved. The community's got to get involved. Well, we have a lot of community activists right now saying we need to get involved and pleading with the police to release body camera video of certain things. So...
And
where does it go?
We've got the city's new Cure Violence program that treats violence with a public health approach. The police are using anti-crime technology such as ShotSpotter. They're also using the National Integrated Ballistic Information Network. They collaborate on that with the state attorney's office. So despite all of this, Jacksonville keeps seeing an uptick in homicides, even though the rest of the state is going in the other direction, less violent crime.
Yeah.
So we are an outlier once again in terms of this massive public health emergency, which is just shows no signs of abating. It's an absolute tragedy for so many families across this city. It's heartbreaking and it's maddening. And, you know, what is it going to take at this point?
A long-term commitment. I mean, we have neglected parts of town economically and in infrastructure for so long. And while that itself doesn't cause crime, it is a contributing factor. We're looking at the way things are going in the Northwest Jacksonville quadrant. I was in Zone 5 the other day at a press conference with a lot of city leaders, and they were calling for some real systemic change on the part of city government, but also in the neighborhoods themselves, which I found quite interesting. The policing tactics is another thing people are starting to question. They're wondering, there was a gentleman behind me who asked, why aren't officers getting out of their cars and starting to become part of the community? Because when you have a police force that's seen as sort of an invader and an outsider, it's harder to build trust. And trust is necessary in order to really address this widespread problem of crime.
So many subject matter experts on this have come into this studio and said that we need an absolute Marshall Plan for big sections of this city. As you said, Claire, with a dedicated funding source that would last over many years, the city tried to do that some years back with the Jacksonville Journey. It was just starting to have a little bit of an impact, and then it got defunded. And so, you know, and the other side of the argument might say you can't solve a problem just by throwing money at it. Well, yes and no. I think that this is a multi-pronged problem that needs a lot of different factors coming together over a long period of time to make a real difference.
That long period of time, I think, is the most challenging part in a political climate where we think 4 years out at best. And so you have programs that are designed to change the course of people's lives when they're children,
right?
You know, so that they don't have murders when they're teenagers. They don't murder people when they're teenagers. That's a 10-year payoff that you have to invest in now.
And look at the ages of some of the suspects that I've been covering. They're 15, 16, 17 being tried as adults.
Yeah.
You got to hit them when they're 8 years old is what some people are saying.
Many of them were divested of services when the budget had to be cut last decade after the crash. That's the thing. So it takes our budget a long time to recover from property tax crash. And we've seen that lost generation. That lost generation was talked about in the 15 sheriff's race. It's definitely come to play here.
Speaking of the young generation, we've got a teenager on the line from Fletcher High School.
Jack. Hey,
Jack is with us from Fletcher High School. Go ahead, Jack.
Thank you, Ms. Melissa. I just wanted to quickly say that it seems to me, at least, there is a high irony that has been happening between the 2015 mayoral election, in which Mayor Curry, I was going after Mayor Brown for the high murder rate, and we've now seen that even go higher than it was back in that election. I do think that through some of the politicization of these committees that are meant to reduce crime, like the Kids Hope Alliance, and you saw all the stuff with the micro grants and the possible violations of ethics laws regarding that it seems like almost a neglect of duty when you are putting the politics ahead of the kids and ahead of the people in the community. And I think one of your panelists did a very good job when they were saying that there is a neglect in our neighborhoods, and it's a neglect that is being continued on by a lot of people in the administration. And that's what I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jack. And certainly both the mayor and the sheriff, the accountability is on the officials who are in power at this time. They own this just as the previous administration owned it.
This generation of leaders said they'd solve the problems, and they haven't been able to.
But to go back to AG's prior point about how we had to cut the budget in the area of the Jacksonville Journey back when the economy took us in the recession, we actually didn't have to cut that part of the budget. As far as
CIP
I recall, we were still watching the courthouse get built, and we were watching various other things, and I realize those funds are earmarked. But the problem is that as soon as things get tough, Jacksonville cuts the budget in these areas because it's not one of their priorities, because the people in, they just, you know, people in city government, it's easier for them to win election next time and to get donations next time if they continue to give the pork out to their people.
But that was the point. When that was happening, the capital budgets were cut, public service grants were cut, there were cuts across the board. When we had the pension reamortization last decade, it was because if that hadn't happened, the city would have had no operating capital. That was a vote at gunpoint.
So here's the public, the public and the private groups coming in. I was at a press conference this week with the Cochran Group, with the family of the 18-year-old Lee High School football player, with his one-month-old daughter literally 5 feet away from me in a car seat, saying that they're going to start putting some of their locally earned funds into some kind of community programs, which, again, as we've talked about, will probably take 10 years to show any result as you work with the 8-year-olds to stop them from becoming that 15-year-old criminal. The private group is working, and our city councilwoman from the district, which has the highest murder rate, then is speaking the next day with others, as you talked about, Claire, about the need for community programs. So the community maybe is going to jump in, and maybe we see some millions of dollars in programs that have been cut by the city.
Here's an email from Bill. Until city leaders are willing to open up the coffers for crime as they did with Lot J, we won't see a lasting change. Priorities, he says. So that echoes your point, Claire. And if you're tuning in just now, we're continuing on with another hot topic from the week on our Friday Media Roundtable. It's 549-2937 to join us. Did you hear about this? Jacksonville Congressman John Rutherford has been accused of racism after he made comments on Twitter calling one of his Democratic colleagues in the House of Representatives an Ayatollah sympathizer. Rutherford got into a big dust-up that went viral because it involved prominent Democratic Congresswoman AOC, or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The two exchanged real barbs over the strike on the Iranian general that resulted in a strike on a U.S. airbase in Iraq. And, of course, Democrat Donna Deegan, who is challenging Rutherford for his congressional seat, weighed in as well. As I call up these tweets, I'm going to read them to everyone. Let's begin with AG, your thoughts about this.
You know, Rutherford's got a competitive race against Donna Deegan, who raised $204,000 last quarter. Rutherford's been kind of slow walking his fundraising since he got to Congress. He hadn't been seriously challenged. This puts him on the radar of the kind of people who write checks. This puts him on Trump's radar. He's going to need real money coming in to message in this one, and this is why he did that. It was a ridiculous statement. It was absurd, but it's the type of thing that Republican donors and base voters love.
And here, and let me read the original tweets. Representative Pramila Jayapal wrote, said at a press conference, President Trump recklessly assassinated Qasem Soleimani. He had no evidence of an imminent threat or attack. Rutherford, I was in the same briefing as you, and this is absolutely false. You and your squad of Ayatollah sympathizers are spreading propaganda that divides our nation and strengthens our enemies. At that point, AOC accused Rutherford of racism by calling a Democrat who had questions about the Iran strike an Ayatollah sympathizer. Donna Deegan then jumps into the Twitter maelstrom and says, instead of apologizing, my opponent is doubling down on his divisive rhetoric. If this is the way he talks about people who don't look like him or me, how can he represent everyone? Florida District 4 deserves better.
I mean, seriously, I read that tweet. It felt like it should have ended with a, you know, I'm John Rutherford and I approve this message. It flat out is, again, not to be cynical, but this is not what John Rutherford necessarily has. This type of message is not how he built his career in Jacksonville. But this is what you do if you're a Republican.
This is particularly loaded, as Deegan points out. Rutherford is taking fire, at least on social media, because, and I'm quoting her, that he called a woman of color a terrorist sympathizer simply because of her faith background. This congresswoman he initially got into it with is Muslim, and so that's the backstory to this.
There's also the idea that some Republicans that came out of that briefing saying it was, you know, the worst thing they've ever heard, and was done poorly and was not convincing. So, you know, for Rutherford to say that he was in the same briefing as she was, and this is absolutely false, isn't necessarily something. There are Republicans who would disagree
and
with
his
statement.
And he refers to them as the gang. That's the nickname for these young, up-and-coming congresswomen that we have in up there, who are women of color, who are women of different faiths, who have been had, like AOC. That's my old neighborhood in New York. That's I have neighbors back there who say she's a little too aggressive for them sometimes.
I mean, don't get into a Twitter battle with a squad, I would advise. John Rutherford, because they're going to win every time.
But are they? As AG pointed out, this helps John Rutherford with a narrow group of donors and voters.
Right. I mean, on Twitter, though, are they on Twitter? Yes, this is spilling over into the actual news. But I would say that the Twitter audience tends to skew a little bit younger and that there's a lot of progressives on Twitter. I think that Donna Deegan, it's an interesting position she finds herself in because she needs to appeal to moderate Democrats and she
and
needs
moderate
to get
Republicans.
Moderate Republicans as well. And by drawing this line between herself, you know, making herself into a progressive on social media could arguably hurt her with those swing
voters.
Here's a
tweet from Perry. Questioning the patriotism of fellow Americans without proof is the lowest of the low. These kinds of exchanges show how much the system is screaming for electoral reforms and real competition for the two main parties. Safe seats on either side are poison for democracy.
Well, you know, the Democrats spent 4 years questioning Donald Trump's patriotism, saying that he's an asset of the Russians. I mean, it cuts both ways. I mean, the discourse has been toxic across the board.
I was there when he was running for president, and so were you. I mean, we heard him look into the camera and basically ask the Russians to hack. Come on.
Yeah, before that, they were saying that Bush was the new Hitler. I mean, you know, loaded rhetoric is part of the American system of politics. Why do we pretend it's a 1950 social studies book? You know, that's the way it's been since the beginning of this republic. A lot of invective, a lot of things said below the belt, and usually the harshest criticism wins.
Well, you know, Rutherford has been very aggressive on Twitter since he became a Washington, D.C. person, mostly touting the programs he's involved with, but every so often, very much a proponent of President Trump. And this was, but this is the nastiest any of his tweets have been.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Well, and that's the thing. At the launch of 2020, all I can say is strap in, because I think the next 10 months are going to get even more intense, nasty, difficult, and worrisome, frankly, for a lot of Americans. The Iran escalation seems to be now on the de-escalation slope. I think that is something to be thankful for as we talk about this. But who knows what is in the next 6 months? I think people are ready at this point for just about anything.
Well, I think that idea of being concerned about where the rhetoric goes, and I get AG's point. I mean, we're not at the point where Congress people are literally, you know, beating other Congress people with a can on the floor of Congress.
Which has happened.
Yeah, when you need them.
Right, but you go back and you look at the, you know, Jackson area rhetoric. Yeah, it was probably as harsh as it is now. But thank God they didn't have Twitter. I mean, the idea that it's not just that the rhetoric is worse; it's that you have it's spread differently. It's people engage with it differently. There's bots doing it. I think we are in a different time when it comes to the discourse.
Let's go to Bruce in Jacksonville. Hi, Bruce. Good morning. Hey, Bruce.
Thank you. That's
I know you've been holding. Go ahead.
No, it's fine. First of all, give you a little background. First of all, my name is Bruce, and I have been in Jacksonville for 30 years. I come from New York, and I am a black man. And I say that so that you have an idea of who I am.
Okay, sure.
Perhaps even my perspective. I am disappointed that Jacksonville can find money for all sorts of things when it wants to, but it cannot solve the dilemma that takes place in Northwest Jacksonville. I say that understanding that there will always be an element of society that wants to do wrong. It doesn't matter where you are until, you know, well, I'll just say until things are absolutely perfect. In which they will never be on this earth, there will always be an element of society that will want to do wrong. I get it. But I think from the school system all the way through the crime or I guess the policing system, there are so few dollars directed at solving the problem of youths who get involved in crime. We can find money for libraries, we find money for federal courthouse. We put money into incarcerating people, but we don't put money into preventing that incarceration from taking place. Educating our children and providing a real opportunity for them to be able to graduate high school and get a job or pursue college. It's disappointing that that happened. I'm mindful of the fact, of course, that through every city, especially in the urban part of most cities, there's always an element like this.
Sure,
always.
Yeah.
And there always will be.
Right, but I hear you, Bruce, in that Jacksonville needs to do a better job. I think you are in line with the views of so many folks out there. So I not to cut you off, but we're getting close to a break, and I appreciate your call. That's Bruce in Jacksonville, summing up a lot of issues that we discussed on the show today. Okay, but before we wrap this up, we want to make note of a lighter headline from the week. The Jag season may be over, but one player is still making headlines all around the country. You guessed it. It's quarterback Gardner Minshew. Yes, Minshew mania is on the road during the offseason as Gardner is undertaking a cross-country road trip in his brand new RV.
When they look back through the annals of history, they're going to talk about three things: discovery of fire, invention of the submarine, and this road trip. Let's roll.
I guess
the invention of the submarine?
I think that's the best bit of it. Obviously, he's going to end it with his road trip. But the second one is the one that killed me. It's not, discovery of fire, landing on the moon. The invention of the submarine?
I know. Now, if you look at the video and follow along on the hashtag Miles with Minshew, our man Gardner Minshew is rocking the cutoff jorts, yep, a headband, and a mustache. He is headed out. I think that last word, he was spotted posting from Texas. I don't know where he's headed next, but I think he's kind of scooting along the bottom of the country out to L.A.
I hope he's going to find a quarterback coach so he can learn how to make a third read before running.
I think that whole thing is the long and shorts of it all, you know?
I mean, I think if Budweiser isn't giving him a sponsorship deal, then what are they doing?
Yeah, really. It's nice to see a little bit of sunshine in all of our dreary news of the week. So follow him on Instagram. Again, the hashtag is Miles with Minshew. Lots of fun. And before we go to break, finally, it's our lightning round. As we talk about other stories that caught everybody's eye this week, Dan Scanlon, what's on your radar?
Well, if you need a job right now, there's about 2,600 jobs that the U.S. Census Bureau is hiring for right now in Jacksonville. So go knocking on doors and taking names and numbers.
There you go. Tim Gibbons.
It's a little complicated, but the JBJ reported this week on details of a plan to privatize parking that the mayor's office knew about long before the general public was aware of it.
Read that story in the JBJ. Claire.
The Florida legislature is coming to session next week. On the agenda is a provision that would require parental consent before a minor can get an abortion. I think child abuse advocates would say that is a terrible idea.
Thank you for that. AG.
Lenny Curry's got a new political committee, Securing Florida's Future. Got some donations this month, Jacksonville Jaguars, Wayne Weaver. The whole donor class hasn't anteed up yet, but you want to follow that committee, see where it goes this year, because it's going to be active.
Thanks for that. And let's also note that Duval County Public Schools is crowing about their higher than ever graduation rate. So making note of that as well. And thank you, Dan Scanlon with the Florida Times Union, journalist Claire Goforth, Tim Gibbons with the Jacksonville Business Journal, and A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. They always add so much to our Fridays. So thanks, guys, and have a great weekend.
Mm-hmm. Thanks,
you
Melissa.
Too. See ya.
Up next, the man in overall stops by with some tips on growing all those leafy greens in your garden. If you've ever wanted to grow your own groceries, he's the guy to see. We'll tell you how right after this.
The New York Times has praised Stefan Jakiv's remarkable purity of tone, which he couples with the controlled intensity this concerto demands. Happy New Year. I'm Courtney Lewis. Our season-long celebration of Beethoven continues with his violin concerto. The symphony is joined by violin phenom Stefan Jakiv on January 10th and 11th. Tickets and more at jacksymphony.org.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. In serious accidents, first responders can now reach the families of over 17 million Floridians. Have you registered your emergency contact information?
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
St. Augustine Distillery, the spirit of Florida. Discover how farm-grown agriculture transforms into handcrafted local spirits. Tours and tastings daily from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Located in historic downtown. Info at staugustinedistillery.com.
Sensitivity to light, a craving for sweets, all things that may let you know you're about to have a migraine. But what's behind all those different symptoms? I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, the surprising things you may not know about migraines, even if you get them. Plus sizing up a new class of treatments. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
There are laws governing presidential decisions about the use of force, but do they still matter?
Ours is not a system in which we can be taken into war by the executive, and it never should be.
President Trump acts, he says, to stop a war. Lawmakers are worried there's nothing stopping him from starting one. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, do you want to turn over a new leaf for the new year and try to eat more greens? How about growing your own vegetables? You can do that whether you have a big backyard or even live in an apartment or condo. Nathan Ballantyne, the man in overalls, is here now with some tips on growing your own groceries. Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And let me paint a picture for everybody. Nathan is wearing his trademark overalls. If you see him around town, you can spot him right away because he's always got them on. You have really built a following around the city, helping people garden at home and grow produce themselves. Why do you think there's such growing demand for that right now?
I think it's a convergence of issues. I think that folks want to be healthy. I think that a certain segment want to take tangible steps towards being a better environmental steward. And I think also folks have this wanting to root themselves in their family heritage as well.
Sure. It's such an old, old tradition. I mean, people have been growing and farming for thousands of years, and in our urban reality today, we've gotten away from it. People want to get back to that, even in a small way, which is what you help them do. Absolutely. If somebody has you come out to their house or even their apartment, how do you set them up to grow produce?
Sure. We support folks to grow their groceries in bountiful, beautiful raised beds. And so we'll help them pick a good spot, good sunny spot, accessible to water, and visible and accessible to them in their life flow. And then we'll develop a design, install, and then plant together. And then as the season goes through or next season, then we'll be in touch to support them as they need.
And you can do a little container garden on your back porch if that's all you have room to do, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I've got a number of customers and a number of folks that have been to workshops who they have these exquisite container gardens on patios, on apartments and things like that. It's awesome.
So what is in season now? What are you planting right now?
If you were going to go outside and plant right now, you would want to plant a lot of different greens. So you could still plant like lettuce greens and everything that you throw in a salad that was green. Especially if you're going for like micro greens, lettuce, all those trays that you buy in the grocery store, that's the kind of thing that you could grow right now before spring hit and you wanted to put tomatoes in the ground.
Now, what about the Florida soil? You have a product called the Magic Mix that kind of helps the greens along because the Florida soil is not always the greatest, is it?
Sure, it's hard to farm beach.
Yeah,
for sure.
I mean, I know this personally because you gave me some of your Magic Mix, and it really made a difference in my little vegetable garden.
Yeah, good soil is where it's all at. Everything starts with the soil. Anybody that is doing natural farming, they'll tell you that as a farmer, your job is to cultivate the soil and make it as good as you can, and then the soil grows the plants.
What are the biggest mistakes people make when they try to do this, and how do you get them on the right track?
Mm-hmm. The two biggest mistakes I see is that folks locate their gardens in suboptimal locations, whether too far away so they don't see their garden, or somewhere where it just doesn't get enough sun. And the second thing is I see people plant things out of season. So I've got a resource called What Can You Grow in a Square, and that's on my website, and it's got everything listed by the seasons. So what you do is you first see, oh, what can I grow this season? And then, you know, from that list, you choose what you want to grow.
But now's a good time to get into this, isn't it, Nathan? I mean, and then by summer, you've got a real crop.
For sure.
For your summer meals.
Absolutely. If you put down some lettuce seeds in 4 or 5 weeks, you could be harvesting that. And then, you know, in early March, you could plant your tomatoes and you'd have those in May. So yeah, absolutely. The great thing about growing your groceries in North Florida is that you can plant and harvest 12 months a year.
Yeah, it is a 12-month growing season. Now, finally, I've got to ask you, you're known as the man in overalls. It's a great shtick. Why did you hit on this? Why do you always have on farmer's overalls? Every time I see you, that's what you've got on.
Mm-hmm. So it started with two things. In my family legacy, my heritage, my grandfather wore overalls every day of his life. In fact, he was buried in overalls. His children put seeds in his breast pocket before they planted him. Mm. But additionally, when I was getting started, I thought, well, I know how to garden. I know some about, you know, financial management, but marketing, how do I do marketing? And I saw this homeless man beside the road with a sign, and I realized I was in this long line of cars. And I realized that his marketing budget was like 50 cents. He had to buy a marker, right? And he was reaching thousands upon thousands of cars every day. And I thought, well, I could do that. Hmm. So I thought, what if I had a sign that said, we'll garden for food, right? And then I just started playing with it. And I thought, well, if I really wanted it to work, I'd need to wear like overalls. And then I thought, well, wait a second, overalls, pitchfork, American Gothic, you know, there's something here. It was just fun. And so I ran with it.
And it took off. It's funny, you know, my grandfather was a farmer, and he wore overalls every day of his life too, and they would look just like yours. So whenever I see you, I think of my granddad.
That's wonderful.
So get in touch with Nathan. Nathan Ballantyne, a.k.a. the man in overalls, and he will help you grow your own groceries. He's really good at this, so give him a call. Now is the time to plant those greens. And as Nathan said, in a few months, you can plant some tomatoes and whatever else is in season. Happy New Year, Nathan. Thanks for being here.
Happy New Year. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. And thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Brady Corum is directing today. Jessica Palumbo is station news director. And our digital editor is Bill Bortsfield. We always value your feedback. Send those emails and comments to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything from today's show, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8. Also, make sure to tune into the Florida Roundup today at noon, our live statewide call-in program where we take the pulse of everything that happened across Florida this week. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Have a great Friday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.